Evening, and thank you for being here. Evening because it feels like it's late because all of a sudden it's October and, you know, the seasons are changing. Thank you so much to all of you for being here. Thank you. Today is Tuesday, October 1st, 2024. This is a city council study meeting for the city of South Jordan. My name is Dawn Ramsey. I have the privilege of serving as mayor of the city of South Jordan with this outstanding city council seated next to me. Mrs. Anders on her way, and we are excusing Mr. Shelton tonight. We also have all of our top key administrative staff here with us. It looks like pretty much all, pretty close to all, and the best team, and we appreciate them. We have presenters here with us tonight, and so we welcome you and any members of the public who might join us or be watching this later. Thanks for being here. We're going to open this meeting tonight with an invocation by Councilmember Patrick Harris.
Our dear Heavenly Father, we're thankful that we have the opportunity to gather together. We're thankful for the city staff that's put this agenda together. And we're thankful for the mayor, city manager, the city council. We're thankful for our guests that are here. Please bless us that as we all interact together, that we'll have thy spirit to be with us, that we can make the best decisions possible on behalf of the city. And we ask this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Mr. Harris. All right, for coordination, does anybody have anything to bring up that you'd like to coordinate? Oh, okay. Mine would just be a couple of things to make sure that we are aware of. Those of us who are going to be going to see the show, we've already RSVP'd for that. We'll get our tickets for that. We have the Pumpkin Promenade will be coming up in a couple of weeks. I mean, it's October. It's crazy that it's October.
What is the pumpkin?
It is the city's Halloween event. It is the 25th and 26th of October is what I have on my calendar. Is that right? Yeah. 25th and 26th of October. And it's fun. Residents can come to the Gale Center and pick up a pumpkin that they can carve and return and bring back. And we're doing that at Mulligan's again this year, right? Yeah, it's at Mulligan's. It's fun. It's fun. Our staff does a great job. It's cute and people really love it. And they kind of come and walk through it and judge pumpkins and just, it's fun. Yeah, it's a cute event. So that would be just something I'd make sure you're aware of. Even though we've got some time before it happens, it's coming up soon. And I don't have anything else that needs to be coordinated at this time either. So if there's nothing else, we'll move on. Okay. Our regular council meeting, the agenda is not long. We have a public hearing on Ordinance 2024-21, adopting an amended and updated impact fee for transportation within the last holdout properties and establishing certain policies related to impact fees for transportation facilities, establishing the service area, and other related matters. And so Don Tini and Fred Philpott, we appreciate. Fred's like an honorary part of our, like he's like not even honorary, like you're part of our team and we're glad you're here. And
it's our honor to have Phil here.
Yes, it is. It is. So we appreciate you being here. And anyway, they'll talk about that. Does anybody have any questions in this meeting about that? Okay. All right, then we will move on. We have a presentation item here. We've got some friends here from Google Fiber. We have an update. We're going to invite you to come on up to the table. And Don Tini will invite you to come up to the table as well, if you will. We're going to get an update about how Google Fiber is going, where it's gone, where it's still going to come, all the things. So we'll turn. I apologize that I don't have your names written down. So if you would introduce yourselves to everybody in the room as well, that would be helpful.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Mayor, council, staff. We are excited to be here. My name is Alberto Garcia. I'm the Government and Community Affairs Manager at Google Fiber. And I'm joined today by Jeff McKay. Jeff, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I'm the Construction Manager for Utah and Idaho.
Yeah, so again, we really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you and just about our progress, what we've done so far, what our plans are going forward. And really just want to start by thanking you, thanking the staff, the city staff for your collaboration throughout this process. Since I wrote it down, we signed this agreement on October 6th of 21. It's been a couple, you know, 3 years, almost 3 years ago. And staff has just been really incredible to work with. And the diligence that they show in protecting the infrastructure of the city. We understand that that's, I mean, you're It's one of your biggest resources, and you're giving us the privilege to be and operate in your city and to have access to that infrastructure. And they take their responsibility very seriously and have held us to a very high standard. And we appreciate that because we try to hold ourselves to that high standard too. And there's, you know, no construction project is perfect. But throughout the project, you know, we've been able to work together. We've been able, when these problems do arise, to work collaboratively to fix them and make sure the city's infrastructure is protected and that we're able to get this additional internet option out to as many residents as possible. So I just had to start this by just saying thank you. So, you know, we're in 21 cities in Utah, and this is one of the best places to work with. And the diligence of the staff has just been amazing. So I just wanted to say thank you again to our partners in this process. So since that time in 21, we have constructed, I've got some stats for you, we have Google Fiber service available to 15,982 homes as of this morning. And that amounts to 1,055,500 linear feet within the city, or 199 miles. Just this year, we have added 5,664 homes. Which is an additional 325,000 approximately linear feet that we've added this year. And we're never done. We're never done. And while it may look like we're getting towards the end of our build in the city with existing permits and with other, with immediate plans, fact is we're never done because there's going to be additional opportunities, which I'll turn over to Jeff in a second to talk about. But then there is what happens. We don't just build and leave. You have construction projects, you have road projects, you have things that are going to impact the infrastructure, and we're going to stay on top of those and want to stay a partner with you as your road construction happens. We don't want to be a burden to that. We don't want to make our plants your problem. And so our team will continue to collaborate throughout this. I mean, we're never done. Once we're in a market for good. And Jeff and his team do an amazing job of staying on top of the infrastructure projects, working with your teams. When a big street remodel project comes, they'll get in there and they'll make sure that we're out of the way before that starts. And so, Jeff, do you want to talk a little bit about where we go from here? I mean, this is what we've done so far. What do we have left to do?
Yeah, so basically where we're at is we're just closing out our existing permits we have right now. And we still have, there's still, at this point, once we get all of our permits closed, we're still looking at other opportunities when they come in, greenfields, any new build, you know, any greenfields like that, or any HOAs that might not have signed with us right now, they might be in a contract, or MDUs might be in a contract. When they're out of that contract and they can reach out to us, you know, we'll be looking to build to all of those that we can. And so then, like Alberto said, we're just going to be constantly working with your street team, and as projects come up, we're going to work to make sure that we don't make our plant your problem and we get out of your way and make sure you guys can do your jobs and we can keep our plant on and move it out of the way if we need to.
And so I'm sure that, thank you, Jeff, and I'm sure the next question is going to be, all right, 15,982 houses is not the whole city. Is it, what about those remaining houses? And I know that a big portion of that, if you want to speak, a big portion of that is
Daybreak. And so, yep, in Daybreak, you know, that's huge out there, and they are locked down out there with one of our competitors.
And what about my neighborhood? It's in the middle, that's not right. Daybreak, that's South Jordan City.
And for that, we are happy to,
a question I get a lot.
I have looked at that before. It's kind of locked up by how I can get there because I'd have to go through Daybreak. And so you're kind of in an island where Daybreak surrounds you. And so we can look at other stuff. I was talking to Don about it, and maybe we can look at, you know, see if we can find some way to get through there and
come up through the Harriman side.
We're not. Yeah, we're going to look at all other options. So, we'll get with Dawn after this and get your information again and get a look at that again one more time and get back to you on that.
Yeah, and if there's some additional specific neighborhoods or addresses, we're happy to go back and look at that and say, hey, come and coordinate and say, hey, here's why we couldn't get there. Is there something that we can do? We can talk about. Is there other options that we can do for that? And we're happy to have a follow-up meeting. We're happy to any of these. If you hear from constituents, they're like, how come we didn't get this? We're happy to provide that information to you about logistically why we couldn't get there, and then do some follow-up to see, hey, if there's some other options that you know, we haven't seen, that we haven't, that we can work with the city to talk about some other potential avenues to get there, because we want as many customers as possible. We want to get to those other areas. And if we're not there yet, there was some initial barrier that stopped us from being there. And we're happy to take those specific addresses and get that information for you. And so that you can respond to the constituent, and that we can do our work on the back end about, hey, are there some other options that we can explore for those?
So for all intents and purposes, are you pretty much thinking we've got most of what we can do in South Jordan done at this point?
Yes, that is correct. At this point, we've got most of, yes, I don't think there's any, Jeff said, there's, I don't even know if there's any outstanding permits yet.
No, we've built everything out right now. We're just in the process of getting them all closed out.
Do you have a map that we could have a copy of everywhere that you've put?
Yeah, we can put one together for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely, we're happy to provide that, sure.
Yeah, we have that.
I was going to say, Marianne has
it. You can have it online.
Marianne has it online.
Oh, yeah, Marianne does have a nice map. See.
We can share that.
I'd appreciate a copy of that. Yes. That would be great. Thank you.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And again, if, you know, as these things come up, we're happy to provide information about what the initial obstacle was and to continue conversations. Like I said, your staff has been incredibly collaborative and trying to work with solutions. And so if there's specific areas, we're happy to go reevaluate those.
And I have been working with Matt and Marianne on different developments as they come up to try to find solutions. So they've been great to work with, and I'd like to give a shout out to those guys. They've been great to work with as far as working with us. So thank you.
I have a question.
So as you guys have gone through the city and into neighborhoods, how much like buy-in do you need of residents signing on? I'm just trying to understand, you know, not going out to like the mayor's neighborhood, even in Daybreak, there's a lot of residents who pay twice for their internet because for whatever reason, the Daybreak HOA internet doesn't meet their needs.
Right.
So they're already using your competitors to get higher service. So I guess just at what point, I guess, neighborhood buy-in do you need to justify it?
You know, and it necessarily isn't the analysis really isn't the neighborhood buy-in. It's we want to go everywhere because we're really confident in our product and think that if we go to a neighborhood, we're going to get a pretty good take rate. It's really the logistical construction components of getting there. And so, for example, in the mayor's neighborhood there, it's trouble getting there because we just don't, we, correct me if I'm wrong, but we just can't get access through Daybreak's infrastructure.
Why?
To get
because
there.
The infrastructure of the road's owned by the city.
So Daybreak is an HOA, and they have an agreement that we have to be able to get in on. And so,
were there easement to just go out to the mayor's? No.
They could be in our street.
It would just be a lot of wire
to one neighborhood.
Yeah, it'd be a lot of wire. I understand that constraint, but it's not anything on the city's part or the Daybreak CenturyLink agreement. It's strictly just a business decision.
Right.
So you have to be able to justify that business cost. And so you have to look at what the buy-in factor would be.
Correct. It's the buy-in factor and the density of the area. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the density of the area.
And I know they had significant conversations with the developer when they first came in and chose not to build in Daybreak.
Yeah, no, but, I understand.
So they have 118 south.
That's what I was mentioning.
Legally,
yeah.
Okay, so we'll definitely look at that to try to get to your neighborhood.
And so you're exactly
well,
right.
Well, it's not just her neighborhood. I'm just thinking of
we'd
projected
love to get into
growth
Daybreak.
That we're going to have on the west side of our city outside of the Daybreak neighborhood.
Oh, right.
And if Daybreak, you know, was being considered as this great obstacle getting to the west side.
Right, because we've got another 200-acre development out west and another 2,300 acres in addition to that. It will all be coming online with the
on the west
side. Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah.
Might as well run that backbone up 118 now.
Exactly. Yeah. Get the backbone done.
And neither of those are part of
it. So, you mentioned HOA's contract. When does the HOA contract come up for Daybreak? Does anybody know how many years?
I don't know.
We were just barely talking about that.
And I think it was a 10-year. I think that.
Is it 10?
I think it was a 10-year contract.
And they just recently signed it a couple years ago? Or
a year. It was a year before Google made their announcement they were coming.
Yeah. So we're 8 years long into a...
Seven
more before we can talk there. But I think to the mayor's point, we've got a huge development west of Daybreak coming on to our city. So I know what you're saying is she's this little island, but honestly, beyond that, there's a large portion of our city coming on. So I get the whole, like, there's a cost... and a return on investment But there is potential out there on the west side, and then you're poised for, in 7 years, you're more competitive. Right. If Daybreak residents are trying to sway the HOA to go with another option.
Yeah.
But either way, to her point, there's a lot coming out there. It's just an investment to the future.
Right. No, absolutely. We're
I'll get back to you next week on that.
25 more acres of development over the next number of years. I mean, it's not all going to be tomorrow, but it's going to be over the next number of years, and it's going to be pretty dense. There's going to be a lot of people there. So it's just
almost another 15,000 homes.
Oh, wow.
Oh, 15,000.
Yeah, we're not talking about chunks.
So that's why I say the time to run that backbone up 118
is now.
Half the size of Dayton.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Do you guys pay attention when there's road construction to get in on it versus having to, you know, splice to the road? So if we know there's a road construction project, say, hey, let's get it laid, like what Dustin's talking about, 118th.
Absolutely. Jeff's team coordinates and usually has the projects for the next year, the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And so then we have a master list of, okay, we're going to get there so that we can get there before it happens. And, you know, one, we don't interfere with your project.
Down.
And then two, once these other, you know, once you open it up, if it's an area where we're not, I know Jeff and his team want to get in there. So
we do
coordinate with your staff. Absolutely.
We will work together. And if we can get down on any joint trench opportunities, get in before you do the road, redo a road, we will.
Great. Yeah.
That's our preference for sure.
Yep.
Great. Anyone have any other questions?
We will explore that, and I appreciate the information about the new development out there, and we can coordinate with you and get some further information on that. But now, like I said, this is a good problem for us to have, because we want people who want our service, and we want to provide that to as many people as we can, and if we can expand that, we'll absolutely look at more ways to do that.
Yep, for sure. We'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, that's great. That's good. Okay. Thank
you. Sure. No, we really appreciate
so
the opportunity to come in and talk to you about our service.
Yeah.
And again, just one more thank you to the staff for their collaboration and their work on this. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Item E2, we have our water utility rates and solid waste fee study presentation. Raymond Garrison, our Director of Public Works, and Vice President of LRB, Fred Philpott. We appreciate you being here. Thank you so much, and we look forward to this and appreciate all the work that's gone into the study. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mayor and Council, and I don't think that Fred really needs an introduction to everybody. He's probably the most popular person
in
the room tonight, especially.
And that's a good thing for us.
It is, right? But I was just going to share that we've been working with him and his team for the last few months, going over the water rates, updating the water rates, the sanitation rates, and the stormwater rate, doing an update to those studies. I will tell you that it's a good practice for us to do these about every 3 to 5 years, and it's been about 3 years since we've last updated those. And so I'm ready to turn the time over to Fred that he can share those results, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Can't go through you.
It didn't work last time I used it either. It might be me.
I'm going to turn it on and off.
Last time I wasn't plugged into the computer.
There we go. Alrighty, as Ray indicated, we've been working on several rate studies. What we're presenting tonight is the water and the refuse utility rate models. We're also looking at the storm water utility rate and the pressurized irrigation, but we're waiting on some additional information relative to capital improvements and other elements on those two models. So I'll hopefully be back in front of you again shortly. To discuss those models. I'm going to go through our assumptions and methodology and talk about the scenarios that we've developed. And I wanted to highlight that these are preliminary scenarios. There's obviously room to solicit feedback, and if you want to see additional analysis, we can do that with our modeling. And if that means creating additional scenarios, we'll work through that. Alrighty, so with each of these financial plans and all financial sustainability plans, we look at key metrics relative to cash reserves and debt coverage and ensuring that we have appropriate targets for those elements as well as revenue sufficiency. So we need to make sure that these utilities are paying for themselves, that there isn't subsidization happening. If there is, there are some entities that I work with that is required or engineered into the utility rate study, but in this case, we're not doing that. We also want to make sure that we can dovetail any recommendations within your current rate structure and billing policies. If there are structural changes, we can work through that. We haven't done any structural changes, meaning changing the nature of your tiering or eliminating tiering or the relationship of your, you know, having a base rate versus a usage rate. We're keeping all of that consistent. This is really about sustainability from a revenue sufficiency and these financial targets. We will look at revenue growth in the model, both natural growth and rate change. So if we program in additional revenues, that will be built into the model. We look at your cost of service and ensure that we're accounting for growth in inflation, as well as new operational needs and capital investment. And then all of that is built into that rate design where we evaluate scenarios that meet the needs of the city while achieving these objectives. And often there are many ways to do that, and so it's a matter of pushing and pulling levers within the model to achieve what we want to as it relates to rate design. Here are the assumptions for water. We're making assumptions, again, relative to connections, usage, growth in revenue, changes in expense. So here we look at historic growth rates and make projections into the future, as well as receiving staff input on how specific line items will change. We also are inflating the capital components of this model. We're using a construction inflation of 4%, which we are seeing inflation become a little more normal relative to meeting that kind of long-term inflationary number. That's something we'll want to watch. If
is 4% just a best practice at this point?
Yeah, long-term inflation is actually a little bit lower when you take out the outliers, so we're still putting a little bit more in there.
Okay.
Your construction cost index or municipal cost index would be sub 4%, so we're putting a little cushion. If the Fed policies continue and you see continued rate reductions that then trickle down into the market, you may see
eventually that could change.
Yes, yes, but the reverse could happen. So again, that's why you look at these regularly. So we recommend actually internal reviews every year to say, how are we tracking in our rates and revenues? Staff does that, and then if something's triggered, it says, wait a minute, we're seeing a bigger jump in some of these costs, and that may trigger a rate review sooner than that 3 to 5 year window. So we just want to watch those assumptions and make sure we're tracking appropriately as we look at updates. Alrighty, in addition to those assumptions relative to revenues and expenses, we also layer in your fund balance. So our starting point fund balance is $15.85 million. Your actual fund balance is higher than that at about $27 million, but a lot of that is going towards the Public Works building and constructing that. So we've removed that from our fund balance total and looked at what's left in our CIP to fund. There's a large tank that needs to be funded and other capital investment, including an annex building in addition to that main public works facility. So still quite a bit of capital investment required in the CIP. We're using not only rate increases, but also a potential bond transaction to fund that infrastructure. So we've layered in that, that tool here to essentially mitigate the rate increases needed. So really the option when it comes to capital improvements, there's three choices. Either we change our level of service and remove capital investment. You rate fund those or cash fund those capital improvements. And that usually requires more substantial rate increases. Or you use a combination of debt financing or rate revenues to mitigate the rate increases and amortize that cost over a longer period of time. The benefit of that third option is you, by amortizing that cost, future users help pay for that infrastructure for which they benefit. The downside of that alternative is the interest cost and the cost of issuance. borrowing comes at a cost to you as a city in the form of interest. And that can be 30, 40% of that project cost that is layered on top of that. So you pay to amortize that cost. So these are assumptions we're building in. Again, if there's concern with regards to some of those assumptions, we can revise those scenarios and show you what it might look like under an alternative assumption. But this gives you the assumptions that we're utilizing in this scenario. Already for refuse, similar methodology here where we're growing revenues and expense based on historic data as well as input from staff. I failed to mention in the previous slide with regards to water, we're using 2023 actuals, 2024 estimates, and then basing our model off our 2025 budgeted numbers and projecting from there. We're doing that across all of these financial plans. In the refuse model, we're combining recycling and sanitation and making sure that we're covering those revenues and expenses for those services that are being provided. Here we have an existing fund balance starting point of $3.9 million. In this case, because the smaller allocation of costs for the public works facility, we're indirectly amortizing that cost in the refuse model of saying, okay, they're gonna pay towards that building acquisition. That fund balance is a little bit lower than what may be needed to cash fund that and pay for all of the needs in the model relative to operating expense and additional capital. So we are allocating that public works facility portion to this fund and amortizing that over a period of time, 20-year period of time. So, oops, I skipped the slide. Nope. Alrighty, so as we look at scenarios, typically in these financial plans, we'll look at a baseline, which is do nothing, assuming the same revenue, rate structure, and you only experience the increase with growth that comes from growth in usage, but not any additional revenue from rate increases. That's our baseline, so do nothing approach. And then scenario two is what would it take to achieve our objectives if we were to manipulate the rates. On the water side, assuming that we have that bond transaction, and on the refuse side, assuming we amortize that cost relative to the public works facility. So that's the scenario two in each of these models for water and refuse. Here you can see when we take no action, our fund balance is below our target amount of 365 days. It does climb, so the trend is going towards that line, but we do not get there. With our debt coverage, you can see when we layer on that potential bond transaction, our debt coverage drops a little bit. And then as inflation continues to impact that model, our net operating income is reduced over time. So that gets a little bit tighter over time as we look at debt coverage. Essentially, what we're trying to do is make sure that you have, when we talk about debt coverage, once you've paid your operating expense, you have, for every dollar of debt, you have $1.25 of net income. That's before you've funded capital or other non-operating expenses. That gives your bondholders a sense of security that you have enough revenue to cover the debt service that should be paid first before that capital investment. So we need to track that and make sure we're staying above that target. Here again, you can see the trend is a slight decrease over time on that specific metric. So if we take action then, here we are proposing slightly higher of an increase than what was presented in the previous iteration of this model. So prior we had a 3% increase every year in this model. We're bumping it up to about a 3.5% increase. There you can see it by 2029, we hit our target and it actually goes above that target. So you may at that point, again, if we reevaluate in the 3 to 5 year window, we could potentially see a change in that if we can back down to 3%. We're recommending right now you keep that 3.5% and then reevaluate at the tail end of this planning horizon.
Can I, your Fred's going to show a slide, but the 3.5% is actually closer to 2% because we're not tacking on to our base rate.
Yes.
And I'm sure you're going to explain this, but so really we're looking probably about a 2% overall on water.
Yes.
Water increase.
Yep.
2% increase or 2% total?
Total. The when you look at the bills,
yeah.
your water bill, it's not going to be a 3.5% increase because on this slide is what shows that. Essentially, what we're saying is no change to the base rate. I should have spelled that out. No change there on your base rate, but 3.5% increase on the usage rate. So it's just going to push that portion of your revenue generation up by 3.5%, but the overall bill will not change by 3.5%.
The reason we're doing this is to encourage water conservation. We're not upping the base fee, something you don't have control over, but the usage we do. So it's a model that encourages water conservation.
Yeah, so those who don't want to experience as big of an increase can change their usage patterns and not have as big of an impact on their bill.
I just presented about this at water school.
You did?
Yeah.
Perfect.
So this shows that here your base rate, your current base rate is at $30. If we propose or adopt that 3.5% increase, your tier one would go from $2.14 up to $2.21, and you see that each tier would go up by that 3.5%. So the average monthly bill would, again, that base rate would stay constant, but you would see a potential increase, or you would see an increase based on usage, but that potential rate at, or percentage change will be different based on how much water gets utilized. It may be closer to that 3.5% if you're using a lot of water. If you're using a small amount of water, then you're not going to experience that 3.5%. Alrighty, on refuse here, similar baseline, which is no rate change, and then what do we need to do to rates to achieve our targets? And on this model, we're just adjusting the rates on your garbage cans. We're not looking at a recycling fee increase. We are also proposing an increase to the dumpster fee, which hasn't been changed for quite some time. That's a small component of your revenue generation, but staff felt it was time to reevaluate that when we looked at some of the fees that were assessed in other communities.
Yeah. So that's when someone orders a dumpster to come to their home?
Yes. Yep.
And really, it's because our tipping fees and all of those costs that we have to pay, the pickup fees, all of that have gone up.
Yes, and that's really the basis for this increase for both the garbage cans and the dumpster fees, is that transportation and tipping fee costs is substantially more than what was assumed in previous models, and we have to account for that in this iteration. So you can see here, if we do nothing, those costs erode your fund balance and we're not sustainable. You actually go into the negative. It is a pretty big increase to those costs that are really outside of your control. Those are passed through. Essentially, we need to cover those in this model and make sure we're sustainable. So in order to do that, this model requires a 9% increase per year to those garbage can fees. And then we're also proposing a 25% upfront increase to the dumpster fee. That's just kind of sucking it all up at the front and bring that in line. Here you can see by doing that, we start to achieve that target threshold. This model is a little different with regards to our cash reserves. It's a 35% target of our operating expense. So as our operating expense goes up, so does our reserve target, which you can see that blue line ticks up over time because our operating expense is also going up, and we're trying to keep 35% of that operating expense as a fund balance. So here is the outcome of that. Again, we're looking at a 9% increase. You've got the first can going from $14.46 up to $15.76 and increasing from there. And then the second can and your senior option can there. I think that's the second can, essentially, if you get another. So those fees would go up by that 9%. And then
$1.30 a month.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it gets at the tail end because it's a compounding.
The percent does look high, and so that's why I just wanted to point out and actually say, which is translates to $1.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
I'm glad we give a discount to seniors. I didn't know we did that.
I don't think I knew that either.
So here is the dumpster fee. Right now, your current fee is $40 per weekday. That would go up to $50. Per weekend is $80. That would go up to $100. We've got some comparisons down here at the bottom. Riverton is at $240. So even with these changes, that 25% increase, you're still lower. I mean, Draper is the closest at $120 and $150. So the percentage increase can appear to be large, right? We're talking about a 25% bump, but relative to your neighbors, you're still below those numbers.
Interesting. How much?
Wow. Yeah. Our friends in Murray are paying a lot.
I was just going to pull out my bill because I was like, man,
So this Riverton.
You should take one home with you.
They'll drop it off Monday, pick it up Wednesday. So that's 3 days. We would have been 150 and they're 240.
Yeah. Yep.
And the reason, I mean, this has been around for a long time, but we wanted to put it at a price point where people won't hesitate to use it. And obviously it is because we get tons of use. The idea is we want people to keep their yards cleaned in that and give them a reason to come and use this.
I like that.
But rather than say, well, I'm not going to take care of this garbage in my yard or the limbs or tree limbs or whatever because it's too expensive to rent something. So we've kept it artificially low. So in essence, the garbage can rate subsidizes this program a little bit, but it's worth it if we have people cleaning out their yards and such.
That's a great perspective. Thank you.
Alrighty. With regards to next steps, as I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, this is still preliminary scenario analysis, providing you information that if you have feedback or additional analysis that you would like from us, we can do that and modify the scenarios as needed. Once we have the preferred alternatives, we will prepare that final rate study and presentation, come back to you for final adoption, at which point you adopt, modify, or reject us altogether. Hopefully we don't do that. But that's the idea, right? We still have some ability to manipulate these models. So if you have feedback, we can prepare those additional scenarios. Questions for me on refuse or water?
Okay, so overarching, if we agreed to this, your average person would pay, showed like $1.20 more for this and a few dollars here. What would be a sum total if this was approved that the average resident would increase their fees on their bill? So, not a percentage. I want to know dollar amount.
Let's go back to this.
How much water are you going to use?
Well, let's just use this scenario here.
Strips.
We've got 80,000 gallon, assuming 80,000 gallons of use.
How close is that to an average resident in our city, 80,000 gallons?
Depends if my son moves back into my home.
Yeah, I mean, your average indoor use is 6,000 to 10,000 gallons for just indoor use.
Mm-hmm. So this is somebody
really
watering
depends.
The lawn and using the house. This is kind
of this is more than just indoor use. You're using it.
Are you assuming this a month or a year?
Yes. Yeah.
A month. So I live on a quarter acre, and in the summer I use about 30,000 to 35,000 gallons.
Oh.
Indoor and outdoor.
And you've got like a fourth of an acre, third of an acre.
Quarter acre.
Yeah. So this would be a larger lot.
Okay. So a lot of residents wouldn't even be close to that amount.
Yeah.
Correct.
Because they have postage stamp yards. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean that's $7 on 80,000 gallons. You're going from 250 to 257. So at a smaller lot, you're probably $3 to $4 maybe increase.
Probably $3 to $4 for the average
per
resident.
Year.
Yeah. Yes.
Per month.
Okay, so
on
let's
water.
Say $3 to $4
per
water.
Month.
That's
no,
per month.
Month.
Per month.
Yes. Yeah,
okay,
per
so,
month.
So $36 a year.
So that would be daybreak.
$3 a month.
Yes.
On water. How much are we increasing?
And
$1.30.
Garbage? Per month on garbage.
That's it.
Yeah, so $4 to $5 a month.
Now, what if someone waters a third of an acre?
Yeah, then it, then that would go
how much
up.
They water.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. How much water do you want to use?
Yeah. So that 80,000 gallons is using more than that quarter acre lot, and that was the $7 a month increase. So again, it will be conditioned upon how much utilization of the system each customer has. If you're using a lot more water, then you'll experience that 3.5% increase. If you're not using any water and you're really restricting that and primarily using the base rate, then so essentially you're staying in tier one and you're not going to have that, maybe experience that 3.5% increase. So it will depend on use.
So when and if this happens, we need to be really good at sending the message about the tiers. So when Rachel, you put this out to the public, they need to understand really clearly that if I keep my water consumption down, I'm paying less of a percent increase. She's not listening, if you'll let her know.
The tiers are on the
bill.
Mm-hmm. But with that, I think we should have a story, like a dialogue. Like we need to market to our residents so they really understand, like, hey, we're trying to reward you for conserving. Like that story message needs to come out. Because the tiers is data. We need to tell the story to the personalities that don't read the data. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think we've done that in the newsletter previously. Like we share the tiered rate. I think Rachel's done a good job to put some articles out on that in years past.
Yeah, when we did the switch to the current rates system, then we did a whole messaging campaign around that. And it was essentially exactly what you said, Tamara.
The story.
Which was we're rewarding you for conserving.
Yes. Yes. So let's do that again.
I think we should
just re-remind them.
One thing I would caution as a legislative body to recognize, and we had some of this with the larger water districts, conservation is very beneficial. Yes. It's very beneficial long-term to change the trajectory of your capital improvement plan. So as you conserve more, your long-term capital investment may be reduced, which, again, has a huge impact financially. In the short term, conservation is a double-edged sword, meaning you potentially lose revenue and your costs remain the same. So rates have to go up again to mitigate that lost revenue. So conservation is a longer-term objective that saves money in the long run, but it may not address your short-term needs. And so you'll just have to watch that again. That may be a trigger point where we say, hey, we're just not getting as much revenue as we forecasted because people are conserving a lot more than we anticipated.
That's exactly what happened.
So, yes, all the water districts were struggling because they were not getting the revenue to sustain the commitments they needed relative to debt and operating expense. And so they had to go back and revise rates. And customers can get upset about that, right? When they say, hey, we're conserving, but our bills are going up. An example is we're working with Ogden, and we can show that some of their large capital investment was being reduced because of that conservation, but that's really going to benefit those future customers and those who stay on the system for long periods of time because we're not having to pay for that future investment. So we need to be aware of that. That's the double-edged sword of conservation. Any other questions? Water, refuse?
Anyone?
Okay.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, I would like the time noted because we made up for a little bit of time. We're actually 10 minutes ahead, which means hopefully we'll have enough time for this whole conversation. We have item F1. We're going to discuss short-term rentals, and we're going to turn to our Assistant City Manager, Jason Rasmussen, and our City Attorney, Mr. Ryan Luce. Invite you both over.
I'm going to invite myself.
Okay,
Charity,
we've known you to come.
Charity.
Who was responsible for not putting Charity's name on this? Yeah. Anyway, thank you. I actually knew you were here.
Come join us over here so they can see you, Jason.
Oh.
He hides in the corner and y'all lean forward to watch him.
Okay. I know you've done just a lot of analysis, a great deal of research and analysis of a lot of a lot of homework on this, and so we're going to turn it over. Do you want me to turn it to Charity? Are we starting with Charity? Are we starting
with
you?
Well, we're
going to
start with where we left off. And so where we left off is we gave you these matrices. Do you guys have your copies? Just kidding. Oh, one brought.
Actually, I didn't bring it.
I brought extras.
You have a copy, don't you?
I do have a copy of yours.
You took the original.
Well, I took a home frame of the original.
You've been hanging out with Dustin too much.
Yeah, I'll sign my own.
And where we left off was looking at what balance you wanted to strike in these nine columns as far as, and you've got it, yeah, as far as do you want to be more heavy regulation or lighter regulation, right? And so where, and I sent you a text in the middle of the last week kind of breaking out where we were feeling and seeing. Jason shared kind of circled the boxes he was interested in. I know, Councilmember McGuire did that, and Councilmember Johnson kind of talked to me afterwards about kind of where she was feeling. And I sent you kind of where we were thinking that we would be. And I got some questions back. And so we want to address those questions and then talk about, again, where you guys want to be. Because based on this, we're going to go back and write an ordinance. And that ordinance, then, if we need to refine it more after you see it written down, will become the new law. And so the question we got is, two of them, do we know how many short-term rentals we have currently? And it's approximately 240, and Charity's got so much information that you'll love it. And she even got permission from a company, a website called AirDNA, late yesterday. So thanks for Phil and his team for accommodating getting this up, that we could actually show it to you here in public versus we're just going to send it to you privately. But they've said they all this is proprietal, and they said we could share it in the public. And then the second question is, can resort cities charge property tax at the full rate on short-term rentals? That's an easy question. Mayor knows the answer. The property tax is a constitutional imposition that any dwelling used as a residence, whether it's rented or not, there's a 45% haircut on the full property tax if it's residential. Right? So no 45%?
Isn't it if it's your primary residence?
If it's your primary, I thought.
So there is a resort one too, but I've talked to Roger too about this a lot, because there's big issues in my mind with how we do big apartment buildings and stuff. There's lots of people that own those and rent them out, like every apartment building. And if you own two properties yourself and they're both your primary, you can only have one as a primary, and there's a property tax thing on that. But it's not the residential property tax constitutional provision. It's another one. So when you think of rentals themselves, all those apartments and stuff, they all get, no matter what, that 45%. Whether they're short-term or long-term. Hotels kind of fall in a different thing. They're not considered the same. But apartment buildings, even if they short-term them, there's no mechanism to trigger that like a hotel, which is one of the reasons hotel lobbies don't love short-terms from that standpoint. So that's the question. There is a lot more on taxes. So Neil and Charity have gone down the rabbit hole. If you have more tax questions, they would love to answer all of them, I'm sure. But I wanted to answer the question put to us first. So with that, why don't we have Charity walk us through, she's got the clicker, the AirDNA, that's the company who would graciously allowed us to use this report. And I'll just say one thing, they don't know city boundaries very well. So don't worry about the areas. We have accommodated for that. Charity and I noticed it right off, and she called them, and they're adjusting their boundaries to reflect better the city boundaries. So don't worry about where that line is. Some of the data will be more focused on how it's compiled for the darkly blue shaded.
Okay,
but there's
so
only 30
I got
homes.
It. I got it. You got
so,
it. Get it.
So what is this AirDNA? I mean.
So if you won't, yeah. Go.
Oh, okay. AirDNA, it's an aggregator for the listed short-term rentals. So they take VRBO, they take Airbnb, they take any of them that are listing, and then they produce data on it. So it's not necessarily intended for cities to use and look at. It's more for individuals that might want to short-term rent a property to see and evaluate if this is a good market for
them.
Yeah,
if you want to start a business short-terming your property. this is the place to go.
But they have really great information, I think, for these purposes, especially since I was listening on the last meeting. There was some concern about, you know, what is really the size of South Jordan's, you know, rental population, and can we get our hands around what's existing now so that we can make thoughtful regulations? And I think there's a lot of information here that'll help us do that. So as he mentioned, all the data that we're going to show after this slide is going to be 30 short-term rentals short. So South Jordan has approximately 240 short-term rentals inside our boundaries, but they do it by sub-area, and the way they did their data, only 210 are in that blue square. You can see the other 30 that are noted there.
And one caveat, there may be some that AirDNA doesn't catch somehow.
Yeah, yeah. So this
is all from that one aggregator.
Yeah, so here you can see this is the sub-area that has the majority of the South Jordan short-term rentals. As I mentioned, there's 240, and we're only going to look at data for 210. So all the percentages, all the charts, they're going to just be off of this group of 210. So I picked out the information that I think is most helpful. There is more information available, so if there's additional questions, we can go back and look for more information. So this is kind of an information explosion, and I understand that. So I put a little blurb at the bottom with what I think is kind of what we should be taking from this. So this shows listing by rental size. That's the top circle chart. And you can see from that over half of the rentals in the city, out of the 210, so out of the majority that we're talking about, over half are just one or two bedroom rentals. That's, you know, it's kind of a smaller group there. And then you can also, I think it's important to note that the amount of time they're rented out. So if you look at the center chart listings by annual availability, it'll show you, you know, which ones are available for what amount of time. And you can see that over half of that is 6 months or less, right? So your super heavy users are less than half of the units that we're talking about. It's more just like the top third is having their unit available for the entire year or most of the year.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please do.
We don't have data that says this, but does a one or two bedroom unit, if 52% of what's up here is a one or two bedroom, that to me doesn't sound like a whole house. So even though entire home, which we'll get to,
houses
in South Jordan that are one or two bedrooms.
Yes, you know? They're mentioning entire home, entire separate space, right? That's how that entire home up there is interpreted. So if you're going to be entirely separate from your host, you're not in the same space as them. So like there's a mother-in-law separate apartment that's one or two bedroom. So it's the rental space they're talking about, not necessarily the entire home.
I get that, but it's isn't it against the rules here to rent out an Airbnb, ADU?
Yes, yes, it is against our current zoning regulations.
Okay, I'm just putting it all together going, I am seeing through this. I am reading this.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
So this is a not necessarily what is legal currently. It's
yes,
just what's
it's
occurring
what's, okay.
currently.
Okay.
Yeah, this
very
is this
helpful.
Is a,
yeah.
a look of
yeah, this is super helpful.
What's going on. Okay, so
and I'd like to put it on the record how much I appreciate AirDNA letting you share this information with us in this meeting. Thank you.
Yeah, so one thing I just want to help us understand, the 240 number that we started talking about, that is the number of units that were available to be rented or were actually booked in the past year, right? So that number is going to be a little fluid and fluctuate. And then if we want to look at the total number of active rentals, so active means what was actually booked or available to be rented. So since not every home is available to be rented the entire year, right? That's the 240 number. Is at some any rental that is available for one day will count in the 240 number. The active number on this slide, the 117 that we're going to be looking at, this is just what was active. So it means it was either rented or it was available in August of 2024. That was the most recent month that we have data on. So in August of 2024, 117 units were open that could be rented or were booked. And then I want to compare this with kind of what the world looked like 3 years ago, because AirDNA, the level we purchased only goes back 3 years. 3 years ago, we only had 66 active listing. So in 3 years, we've essentially doubled the number of rentals that are available or that are being booked.
And then if you go back further, we ran our first report with AirDNA, and it looked entirely different back then in 2016. And at the time, there were 48.
Yeah.
So I'd say, unless there was fluctuation between that we can't see, if you just go from 48 to 66, 2016 to 2021,
September.
That's pretty consistent. And for years, people would ask, well, why aren't we regulating more? Because we just didn't have that many, and most of the ones we had then weren't popping up as problems. You see the graph climb, and with that, it have become more problems.
Yeah, the other piece of this puzzle is what this is going to show. So this is talking about occupancy rate. So this is how much each rental is utilized. And so Ryan mentioned that there was a report that we ran in 2016. And back then, we only had 48 that were active. But the average occupancy back in 2016 was 16%. If we look at, that's just August's number, it's 60%. So each rental that is getting rented or that is available is getting used for much more of the month than it was previously. And then if we look over the last year, that first little squiggly graph next to the 60%, that shows kind of a low and a high of occupancy rate over the last 12 months. So the lowest occupancy rate was 46 in November, the highest was 73 in June. So the city over the past 12 months kind of sits between 50 to 70%, depending on which month, on how much these are occupied, which essentially breaks down to, you know, 12 to 17-ish days per rental per month. So that's really what we're talking about. I know I just spewed a lot of numbers at you, but we're looking at the 117 that were actually available or rented. Of those 117, the average in August was approximately 16 to 17 days those were in use. Each one on average. Yeah. So that doesn't mean each rental was necessarily rented out 16 days, but on average. So some of them might have only been rented a few, other ones were rented continuously for an average in that range. And then this actually really surprised me. The total days booked over all rental, they aggregate just like the number of overnight stays in that month. And so for August of 24, if you aggregate over those 117 rentals, it was 1,600 nights that someone was sleeping at a rental in South Jordan in August, which surprised me. That was higher than I would have anticipated. So bearing all that in mind, I don't know if this is helpful or not. This just shows the different pricing points where the rentals sit in South Jordan based on how they've decided to separate the what's offered. I think this slide, I put it in because I think it's important to see that these, right, are making people money, clearly. Obviously, these are earning people a lot of money in some of them, $400 a night, you know, down to $95 a night.
So what is room rates in South Jordan with the hotels?
They're in direct competition with the hotels. So, and currently they're not regulated as heavily, right? They don't have the same restrictions, requirements, you know, taxes should apply, but I mean.
So can we look up really quick that hotel by the district, sir. The one that it sits by Texas Longhorn? Look that up, and what's our average room rate there at night? Is it like 190, 210? I'm just curious.
You don't name
it's a Home 2 Suites, I think, by Marriott. Is it? Not Marriott. Is it a Fairfield?
Is it Spring
Hill? Spring Hill. Spring Hill.
Okay.
I don't know, we drive past all the time. I don't know what is it.
I know, I was going to say, it just right past.
Do you want me to keep talking while
yes.
we look?
Yeah.
Or, okay. I didn't want, I mean, I'll wait. I'm not trying to rush anyone along. Okay, so this, you know, to me, this just indicates, right, that these are probably more like businesses than they are like, you know, residential
they
uses.
They say from 145 a night.
What was that?
Yeah, I'd have to try to book a room. It probably depends on all sorts of options.
Okay.
I know the ones we typically get down in St. George and stuff are closer to like 250.
Right.
And stuff. So
it's peak.
And it's going to depend on season and a bunch of things.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing to keep in mind, obviously, these are different size accommodations, right? Hotels typically 2 to 4, and these can be, that's going to come later. Yeah, how many people we can fit in these. So these next couple slides, This is showing the number of, I sorted the data by the number that each host is renting out. So if we're only looking at a host that just has one property that they're listing, right, that's 75 out of our 210, which is about a third, right? A third of them, just one person has a listing and they list their unit. And then if you look over next to it, the 2 to 5. So this host is listing 2 to 5 distinct units. So those could be separate properties or they could be, you know, bedrooms, right? But they're separate listings because they're rented separately. I hope that makes sense.
And we don't know if the host has all 2 to 5 in our city or they could have units.
Yeah, so this,
it's going by the host as I have. They're saying the host is
not the location of the
unit.
Yes.
They could be in Park City. They could be, who knows?
So they are hosting one at least here, but then they can be hosting additional. And so this shows maps and the dots indicate each one of those 75 or 71. And then also important to note is that hosting doesn't necessarily mean ownership, mm-hmm. right? So it's just who's listing it. They're doing it off of the listings.
And maybe renting the unit and then subleasing it out.
Subleasing.
Mm-hmm. Or something like that.
Yeah.
The owner may know, may not know.
May not.
There's just no way for us to tell.
And then these are the higher counts, right? You can see 6 to 20 hosted units or 21 plus hosted units. So then you're really getting into people that know how to write listings and this is, right, this is what they're doing. And those two combined account for a third as well of what's currently existing in South Jordan. If you add up the 37 and 27, you're looking at about a third of properties fall in this kind of larger hosted category.
You remember, we don't know where they are. We don't know if they have many in the city or not. And I don't even know if that's Utah confined. They may be hosting.
Virginia,
if it was Utah confined?
It could be anywhere.
So it could be a company that does hosting.
And then this slide I thought was important to kind of give us an idea of the, you know, we looked at, you know, how many were one bedroom, two bedroom, but I did a sort by what can accommodate up to 8 individuals. And that's essentially 3/4, right, of the units that are offered in South Jordan. And then what are kind of the big ones, right, that can, you know, 16, 20 plus where you're looking at entire homes. And that's a full 25%, right? That's 53 out of our 200 listings. That it is an entire home. It's a large home. They're even advertised because we can see all the listings. They're even advertised 16 plus people sleep a whole family reunion, you know. And so I think that that's kind of important to understand because that could be where additional issues occur and additional regulation might be necessary.
So like the parking things we're talking about, if you park all on there, once you get to a certain number of people, it's just not going to work.
Well, that's like the sports team with the bus, they call that.
They're renting one of those.
Or one of our first problems back in 2016 that we looked at one of the big houses along Chapel Ridge down there for Thanksgiving, did a rental, and so a bunch of other people invited families over, and so you had the neighborhood all in big houses, all inviting families. And the rental one just added to the parking, and it got so people were walking a half mile just to get to their Thanksgiving party, and that's what was brought up. And so it became a problem parking for that, which the residents say, well, I live here, I pay taxes, I invest, my guests should be able to park on the street. Why is this happening that's pushing my people out? And it's a legitimate concern. It was a one-off. We didn't get that repeatedly. I don't think we saw that in subsequent years, at least not that I heard, Chief. But that's when it first came to our radar and we started looking at it.
And then just finally, this is the last one. The other piece of information on this slide I thought was helpful to understand. Only 15 out of our 210 that we were looking at data on are managed by a professional management company. The other 195, which is, you know, almost all of them, right? It's just the owner or, you know, unprofessional managers, right? So it's just regular people that are managing the issues with most of these and offering these for rent.
I mean, if you pull it up and look at it, a lot of them are just people's basements or their their ADU. I mean, they just are. You know,
the one really big problem we've had, the one problem property we've had lately, that he came to you and asked for some change in the rules. He was renting the shed. He's been renting bedrooms.
My
he striped
friend.
His in your district, yes, council member. He's striped his driveway with was it 12 parking spots, council member?
He's got 12
spots. Striped and
striped
numbered
parking lots.
And
in,
he's even got it striped
driveway.
In front of the garage. He's
yeah.
figured out a way of how to back his car out of the garage and still have cars parked there.
Yeah, so he's got it striped and all arranged to get 12, but that one, they're not separate ADU living spaces. They're more the bedroom type of space, and for all we know, some couch and some bunk beds for 12 people. So from that standpoint, you've got a mix of everything going on from the standpoint of rentals in short term. What we're asking is, does this fit? Now you've got a little more information on kind of what's going on. What is the right fit for South Jordan? That is great, but what we really need to do is what you're hearing from your residents, what you're hearing from those, if you know people who are short-terming any of their properties, and we're not talking about the long-term rentals. If law applies a little bit different to people who are renting their houses for 30 days or longer, you know, year-to-year, month-to-month contracts. So just in this, it felt like you weren't at the point where you wanted to require the on-site manager, but you wanted a manager close enough that they could respond within a minimum an hour. Is that
what
we're
thinking?
I
think that's what Councilman Shelton put on his write-up.
Yeah, I think he put that
one
on.
To 3 hour
and that's kind of what I send out as kind of the aggregate. Because what I want to do is be able to bring back to you in a week or two. And well, first of all, I want to give you some time in between this meeting and the next because you're not used to it. So we'll give you that time. But secondly, if we can like pick which ones, and we'll bring back in a meeting or two an actual ordinance that you can impose. And that we can go from there. So it sounds like, and maybe some of you, I know Mayor received comments from a member of the public, someone who lives in the city that has been dealing with this. And so if you've got those comments, if you've gotten anything, those are good to tell us here too. So on the requiring the inspection part, everybody picked that I saw require all the inspections that first.
Well, especially month. If they're having people come in. As being an appraiser, you don't know how many times I've had to write up things that are missing when they have gone in their homes and done the work themselves.
We don't want to respond with our fire department and find out they're putting a bunch of people in there and the house wasn't near code. And so this gives us a chance through a business license process to require that inspection. So the fire safety, owner management, it looks like you want that second box. Mm-hmm. Now, do you want 1 to 3 hours? Do you want 1 hour?
I think the 1 to 3 hours is good. So that way, if an owner is somewhere, you know, maybe they're busy in another part of the state, kind of gives them a chance to come back easy enough.
Remember, if the owner is going out or whatever, they could designate.
Yeah, they can designate someone
or they can choose not to buy it during that time.
Yeah,
I'm not going to be available to manage my property.
Yeah,
that's a great thing. So I think you got one of the things. This is one of the things for a place when they go on scene on one of these. If they know it's a rental and there's a number call for the owner, that gives them someone to help hold responsible. Hey, you've got a problem here. You come help us take care of it.
Yeah, I like the 1 hour just.
Yeah, police will take care of criminal violations, but at the same time, if it's on that edge, we don't want to arrest everybody all the time, so that gives us... So you're saying
just
maybe
to,
one?
Sorry, just to add perspective, Mill Creek has 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So,
like
3 hours.
Well, and other places have a little bit longer. There's the whole gambit. That's why we didn't do a city-by-city comparison. Charity's been going over. There's the gambit. There's some that don't require anything, so it's really hard to say, but that's a great...
But will this not also allow the residents who live around it have a contact?
Yeah, they'd be able to see who the contact number is on the door, too.
I think that would also be very helpful, not just for the city.
Some cities require that under signage requirements, so they require either like a posted sign on the outside of the property, so when someone comes over, they can have the manager's contact.
That's what I would recommend if you're not having the person on site. I think those two go hand in hand, because then whether it's a resident, neighbor, or whether it's the police or the fire, they know who they can contact to say, hey, you need to get here to your property or to your responsibility.
Is that the property at risk? Having it posted, hey, we're a short-term rental property and we don't always have people here.
Well, same as a business in the evening.
We'll get pushback about that.
Yeah, maybe, but a business is in the evening when no one's there, they have the same risks.
Yeah, but I think we'll get pushback.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that is the balance, right? How easy do you want to make the communication to the owner manager versus how much do you want to advertise that?
The other way we can help police out is we can have that all on file through business license, but it's really hard for an officer at 1 a.m. to go find where that file is with all the information. It's easier if it's just posted.
It's best it's just posted somewhere in the house that they can see it easily.
I guess you could put it in the house.
Well, not necessarily in the house, but I meant just on the house.
Well, if it's in the house, police can usually get to it.
I think for us, as long as we can get access to it, so if we had it through dispatch or through the city, and we knew how to get a hold, if it was on the city business license or something.
Yeah. I mean, for me,
that's all we would be concerned about.
Any short-term rental I've ever stayed at, there's usually like a chalkboard somewhere kind of in the entryway, where you see it right away with the contact information.
Contact, the Wi-Fi.
Exactly.
So do you want to do 1 hour? Yeah. Or 2 hours or three?
I like one.
One?
I'm okay with 1 to 3.
I'm okay with 1 to 3.
I like 1 to 3 is what I prefer.
Yeah, 1 to 3 is fine.
Let's try and get it in one. But it
1 to 3, and then posting on the inside.
Yes.
So if officers walk in or fire responds, it's somewhere on the inside.
Sometimes they don't answer the door though.
We still do the lister business license.
But if we're going to decide it has to be licensed, then the city would have access to it.
Well, we have to get the list to where the cops can see it 1 in the morning.
I mean, it could still be posted on the house. It wouldn't have to be like blaring so someone driving by could see it.
Neon.
But if even if it was posted near the doorway,
it's up to you guys.
Oh, yeah.
In another city that I work in, we get an ordinance. It's just about like that big. And it's like on the window on the front door.
The size of
and
this.
And it just says, this is who's managing it.
So you'd have to walk up to even notice it.
Yeah. But the neighbor could, it's worked well that a neighbor can call that person and say, hey, they don't want to call the police, but they can say, hey, there's a problem going on, come take care of it. Before the police even get involved, but it's just a small, couldn't see it from the street. When you go up the thing, you can see it on the door.
Could be something that, you know, size of many of the no soliciting signs that everyone
has. I wouldn't want it to be this size, because I think that makes it very easy to drive around and go, okay, all of these houses have that size paper in their window, that means that's what they are.
But if it's just like a no soliciting sign style next to the doorbell or something like that.
I've seen tons of those in my day.
Yeah. It's not necessarily like the paper. It's like the no soliciting signs. It can be the letters that are cut out, so it doesn't have to be this scripturous thing. But anyway.
All right. Do you guys want to put a limit on total nights?
I don't know how you can monitor it.
What's the advantage?
We require them to keep a booking log, just like hotels do.
And you check it every year.
You think that they'd be honest?
Well, it's
when we have information, right?
If they are consistently, it makes it easier for us to revoke their license.
It's not about the longer, it's just how many nights they can rent out their property during the year.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. How many cities do that?
I kind of lean away from regulating that one.
Too. How many cities do you kind of have a recollection of how many have a night regulation?
No, it's just, so there's different ways, obviously, to limit these. You know, you can limit occupancy, you can limit the days they're available, you can limit the number of units a host can have.
But
right?
How many
and
we're
so
limiting the days available?
It's all over the place.
That's why we didn't
That's
do
not
it,
the
so.
Only limiting
I think I'd rather limit how many people
or the number of
that's
units.
That's the next
per
one.
Per
so I'm hearing. No limit on the nights, but then on the number of people, where's your limit?
I mean, if somebody's renting out a 6,000 square foot home, right? How do you?
That's what you. That's what you have going down there on Chapel.
Right.
Two per bedroom is what it says
between that and parking. That would limit it down.
Yeah, and parking's down the next one. So one of the ways that you do it by the size of home is that first box where you have so many per room.
If we go back to when you said you had complaints, it was people complaining about the cars.
Yeah, the
mostly
parking.
We've heard that people are upset when you encumber on their street space.
Additionally, on that one, there's people upset about how loud they were, that some of the people were drinking beer in the front yard, some of the people were swearing, but most of that behavior is commonly allowed.
I don't know that number five is one we need to dive into as a government body and get in the minutiae of it, but what if we just go into more of like what we do for ADUs, and there has to be parking accommodations, like you have to accommodate for the parking.
Yeah.
That will limit the people immediately.
I agree with that.
If you want no limit, that's fine.
Just to bring up another one I've seen, so
Hurricane.
That one.
Yeah.
Thank you for the help. They say it's a maximum of 10. And
10 people,
but if you want to go more than 10, then they have additional requirements. So then they want additional fire inspection. They might want like fire suppression, right? Because if there is like a bigger disaster, you know, when you have more than 10, you're not necessarily looking like a home anymore. You're looking more towards hotels, right? So they want additional safety. And so they'll give people up to 10, but then after 10, there's additional.
No, but 8 years ago today, I rented a whole house in Hurricane. Because I happen to know it's 8 years ago today, because that was when I ran the St. George Marathon. And we rented a home in Hurricane for the whole family.
Yeah.
As a renter of a short-term rental, I was glad there was one, because there were no hotels anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, so they just require additional steps on
that,
the...
As the
yeah, but you
person
would never
renting
see
it,
that.
I wouldn't
yeah,
have known.
Yeah, you wouldn't
that.
Know.
Yeah.
How many people did you have, more than 10?
12, I think.
So assuming they had
ordinance
in place back then, that house would have had additional safety features.
Yeah. I actually think it's kind of smart.
Yeah. Well, I think if it's tied in with maybe up to 10, and then, you know, unless the fire department inspects and approves more or something. Because I was just thinking, I've done similar to where we've gone with friends and our two families, that's 11, 12 people right there.
Well,
so you need to be able to allow that larger number, and there's plenty of homes that can accommodate it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, maybe you do look at having just the fire at that point, make sure it's really inspected, that they're not shoving too many people into one bedroom.
Well, and if the property is like a 1 acre lot,
yeah,
and they have plenty of parking, then it's not a problem.
Parking will limit some, but remember on the parking thing, if people Uber in, if you get a couple 15 passenger vans, and you can fill up a house pretty quick with two 15 passenger vans, you can put that softball team in there.
Yeah.
And a softball team on a 1 acre staying for 2 or 3 days may be a different impact than a softball on a fifth of an acre house staying for 15 or 2 or 3 days. So those are just things you guys weigh out. Because while we're clearly restricting the commercial vehicles like the bus parking and creating a problem, there's other ways to get a similar number of people there pretty quick and pretty easily without the parking being a problem.
You mean creative people?
Yeah. I mean, if you're a coach and you've got a team, you may just get two vans.
So let me back up and ask a simple question. Currently, we have no guidelines, zero.
The main thing we regulate on short-term is that they can't be part of an ADU. So if you have an ADU, you can't short-term it.
Even though there's a ton of them listed.
Yeah.
Okay, so how are the ADUs
that are listed, those aren't legal ADUs through the city.
Yep.
And so that what it means is
which
someone
we
were
have
to
no
report
control
them. Yeah, if someone were to report them, we go say, you need to be a legal ADU. They would come in, work through the planning process, and as part of that, they'd be told you can't do that.
Right.
And
I
we've had
and our hands are tied on that. I understand that.
Well, we
that,
it's us knowing about it. And so, I mean, we can start to enforce our ADU that way if we choose. But rather than using the same as start enforcing ADU, let's make this policy and then enforce both.
So with this policy, though, they could use their ADUs as
That would be one of the things we propose is if you adopt a short-term rental policy and they fit within it, then why wouldn't you let them use the ADU? Or if you don't want to, you don't have to.
Oh, no. I just figured
it seems to make more sense at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's...
Too. I think it does, too.
Currently, it's not allowed. Isn't it have to do with making housing more affordable because they want the longer-term tenants rather than...
We just didn't allow it as part of... We weren't promoting short-term rentals. There's some state policy stuff that will... I mean, short-term rentals are being scrutinized by the state for just what Charity was talking about. But I don't know that we... That was like the clear articulated reason. I think it was part of many reasons. I mean, in the end, we weren't pushing short-term rentals, so why allow them by right in ADUs?
So I'm intrigued by what you said Hurricane City did, because I being so prescriptive about the number of people that can rent a unit, I don't lean that way. I'm not, I don't favor that. Because I don't want to legislate everything to a worst case scenario, because there are anomalies. There are one-offs that happen and we deal with them and it's not ideal. But for the most part, that's not how this goes down. And so putting what I think are kind of extreme regulations in place, like saying you're not allowed to have more than 8 people ever rent the house at a time. My family couldn't even go there, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't, that's too far for me. Just stay me. I'm just letting you know how I feel.
I think this first one where it says, you know, 2 people per bedroom or 10 people, but then adding the caveat that, you know, we would add more, they have more people and carve out what that unit would have to look like in order to handle that more people, like space.
Which I like that. I'm interested in that. Like, agree with you. Like what you said, Hurricane City. Okay, if you have more than 10 people, there are additional things that apply. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is really intriguing, and I'd like to explore that. How do we
do that?
Look at that?
Chief,
you know?
We're putting you on the spot a little bit, but are there things that you would require in a house with more people than 10?
Yeah, so that would be in your fire safety-related stuff specific to exiting, for example, possibly fire sprinklers or things of that nature, because our fear would be that you put too many people in a house not designed for it. If they had a single exit, for example, and that was blocked, we could have a real problem on our hands. And so it would be, you know, from our perspective, more people is fine as long as the building has the appropriate, again, exiting and fire safety features to accommodate more people.
And so we'll just go with that one, and we'll just have Chief work with us for that.
I know somebody that owns one in Hurricane, and they made that because they wanted, it was a large home. They had them fire sprinkle the home before they were allowed to. So that's one of the things. I don't know all of the things that they do, but that's one that they, if you were over 10, you had to fire sprinkle.
And with our residential facilities, whether it be, you know, for any ADA type of event, sober living homes, beehive home type things, we require that when you get to a certain size, certain number of people, you have to fire sprinkle the home or have the thicker sheetrock. And that's why a lot of them will build new rather than refurbish a home, because it's harder to strip it down and put all that in. But those are things that we've done regularly, and so happy to look at those, and we'll build those in and just go. It sounds like you're all okay getting up.
Yeah. So on that one, can we just make it like 10 people unless fire department inspects and approves?
Do you want a total max, though? Because the issue with the fire department is, not the issue with it, but if we say there, what if the people want 30? I mean, I guess if it's big enough. I
guess the house is
big enough. Because I think that's where this comes in that's, I really like, is either so many per bedroom or so many per square feet. Some of those things help us determine, because we've all seen the ones that don't have a bigger.
It seems less arbitrary.
It is
giving
less
a arbitrary. Firm number seems arbitrary that may not fit every scenario, and I don't want.
But we've all seen a place with like a great room that they've put 15 bunk beds in.
I've never seen a place like that.
Oh, I've seen places like that. Okay. Spend a little time on this website. She'll show you a couple. What was the most you saw that fit in South Toronto?
Oh, I don't know. It was 20 plus.
Yeah, I thought you told me one
in
was 40.
Uh-huh.
I think she,
well,
I thought
you rent
said,
out the whole home, and then it can accommodate.
I thought you said
large
something
groups.
Like 40.
I don't
remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So can I have 7
Can we do a tour these places?
Yeah. So from that standpoint, why don't we look at some other examples of stuff, and we'll just do either number of people per room or people per square feet. Some of those type measurements we'll bring something back to you that fits within that matrix. If we have more questions, we'll send them out to you.
One thing we haven't discussed is number 8.
Yep, we're getting there. I'm going down the list. That way I know we've got them all covered. So do you have a preference on limiting short-term rentals on the property? In other words, if they have a guest house or a separate ADU in and they want to move out under the ADU law, the state allows us, and we've chosen to stay with, if you have an ADU, you have to live there. Now, do you want them to allow two separate short terms in the same property?
Let's say you come out of the gate restrictive. I have a text from a resident who said, you should come out of the gate really restrictive and then back off.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, if we come out of the gate as a city and we're super restrictive and we've come up with some rules that everybody hates, what's the recourse? How do we back out of
this?
It's under
business license. You just change it. We do a normal
notice.
We just
sit down.
It's not land use.
Make a change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not land use where we take it through planning commission that. We're keeping it under business license where we can be more malleable. Now, what I'll say is those licenses renew annually. And so they would get the benefit of the new rules when they renew it,
mm-hmm.
or if they cancel their license and did it.
But a
moving target might be harder to enforce,
right.
too.
How many of these people actually have a business license?
None, because we don't require it.
The city doesn't have regulations.
So moving forward, what would our process, I mean, this is kind of a process question. We can sit here and pretend we know what's the best idea, but then how does this unfold?
Process, once we have the rules in place, we know where all these dots are. We have addresses linked to them. We'll work with business licenses.
So Brian's going to knock all the doors and say.
Well, we're going to do a letter
and
reach out.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I know.
Yeah.
You know, some cities, like when they did the ADU laws, they, you know, when that all came out, they put it in their newsletters.
We're personally planning
to contact every dot and say, hey, we have STR
rules.
We'll
send out a letter and let them know of the recently passed ordinance and what the requirements are and that they need to come get a business license.
Okay. And when you don't hear from them, then what?
Well, if they, in there,
I mean,
they'll have like 30 days to come do it or 60 days. We'll put a time. If we don't.
And then what?
I've got prosecutors. We'll just start working with them to come in compliance. We'll start with code enforcement.
Like any business that doesn't have a license operating without
the
license.
Code enforcement process is usually at least a couple months to really tell them we're serious. If they keep ignoring us after we send them the courtesy letter and we get code enforcement involved at a certain point, then we would file an information for
so case in point, if we come up with a number here and somebody's got an STR and it doesn't work for them, they're like, what the heck? You told me I can only have 10, but I have a house with 7 bedrooms. They don't get a variance unless we change our city ordinance.
Well, there's no variance. I mean, that works alone
in
land use. But there's no exception. You're putting rules into place.
There's no exceptions.
Yes. You're putting rules in and telling us how to do it.
So I think as a body, we need to decide, do we want to come into this and approach it kind of less restrictive and then ease into it? Or do we want to come out of the gate and be like, here's the line, and then we maybe see if we came in too strong? I mean, that's something to consider as we're piecing this as piecemeal. I think we should decide, are we wanting to come out and like be like, that's it, let's be restrictive, or do we want to ease in and be like, hey, let's step into the arena?
One advantage we have.
Like, does that make sense to you guys?
Well,
yeah, but I think that we're kind of doing that is by giving this input tonight.
Yeah.
And I'd say one advantage you have is just that by waiting till now, we do have a lot of examples. There's a lot of these things and choices. We have a lot of information to start making choices. We're happy to go get more if you want a listing of what other cities do. I don't know how beneficial it'll be because it is really scattered. They're all choosing what's best for them. But the information we have for you right now is these are the main things you have to decide on. If you're uncomfortable with one, tell us what you're uncomfortable with, and we can work on that. And I know Brian and Charity both have their hands up.
Well, my thought is if we decide to go easy and say, well, let's see how it works, and then we can toughen it up, that won't work. Because once these people get the letter, once they see what there is, they're going to start resistance from that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be better to come in. The way I look at it is, These were sold originally when I bought my home and when you bought your home. You bought a residence.
Mm-hmm.
you weren't planning for your neighbor to be in business. And I understand the economy has changed and people want to do this, but the way I see it is they can do it as long as it's not going to be a huge impact on their neighbors. So let's look at how we can modify this so the neighbors will get the least amount of impact. I mean, they'll have some, but try to keep the neighborhoods as neighborhoods.
Yeah, I could comment here. So, I mean, I've heard a few comments from people, and some of the comments I've heard. From residents, but also from this body right here today. But, you know, where people on this body are making comments about their experiences when you're renting properties. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming everyone in this room was just a fantastic renter. You know, you guys didn't cause any trouble. And you were probably ideal renters. Jason smiles.
We are ideal renters.
I'm always ideal.
I've only ever rented one Airbnb, and it was
but,
that one. So.
But that's not... Honestly, I don't think that's the concern we're addressing here today. No. Is people that are going to be responsible and good renters. There are people that go to rent these things out there that cause problems, and we need to be able to make sure that we're protecting the people outside. So I think sometimes it's like, well, what, how was it like when I rented? I want to make sure that those people can come rent in our city and have that same experience. I think there's reasons why we have some of these. I mean, I did a little research, you know, online too, and there are some nightmare stories out there. People renting properties out there, and I think that's for me. When I'm looking at this, I'm looking at that. It's okay. I want to be reasonable, but I don't want to be so broad out here either. That makes things very difficult on the other people in the neighborhood.
And Chief pulled some numbers, and Jason's ready to give those of kind of our experience with that.
Yeah,
I think I would encourage you from both the enforcement standpoint. Through code and through the attorney's office and prosecution, because eventually you get there, right? Everything you do, law-wise, you do at the point of criminal enforcement. Mm-hmm. That's why you set laws. I would set the regulation you choose to set, and I think you guys have to determine where that is. Mm-hmm. I would leave it for at least a year or two. When you say scale it back from a report, if that happens frequently, mm-hmm. it becomes extremely difficult to administer. It's better not to have rules or just to prohibit it entirely, an all or nothing scenario than a moving target. And that's for the businesses too. That's for them too. It's for all of us.
Yeah, I'm just gonna give an example of when we started regulating and allowing food trucks. We put the ordinance together. We kind of thought, okay, what are our fears? What are we heard? What are we seeing? And then we put together an ordinance, and then we actually, I can't remember if we wrote it in the ordinance or if it was just part of the motion or whatever, but it within a year, we came back and we re-looked at mm-hmm. it, and we said, no problem, this is ridiculous. You know, oh, this needs to be strengthened. And we went through and then rewrote the food truck ordinance so that, but we had some, you know, we have these kinds of numbers. Yeah. Then we knew kind of how many food trucks, whatnot. Then we had ordinances, we had experience under the ordinance. Okay, what's enforceable, what's not enforceable, what really doesn't matter, what didn't we think of that we needed to, and we kind of made a plan from the beginning to relook at it in a year, and there was quite a few of the stuff we just said, didn't happen, not worried about it, you know. And then there were other things, you know, a few other things we'd strengthen. So that's what I would suggest is you kind of write the ordinance you want. Let's think of what our worst case fears are. Let's try to regulate around that. And then in a year, let's reevaluate.
Did you have charity?
Oh, I was just going to, I mean, I don't want to jump ahead on Ryan, but what I have seen other cities do to try to help the neighbors or the neighborhood, right, have been these limitation on total number of licenses or the dispersion requirements so that you don't end up with 14 of them on one street, right, and then only one person that actually lives on the street. So something like that might be, you know, an option to still, you know,
they
to think about
keep
on
going
how you...
down through the list before you jump there, because if you skip one, we'll just have to come back. That's why I'm trying to get on the numbers.
I'm not used to having as much time as we have. I've checked my watch 100 times because I'm used to being out of time. I'm
too.
Especially
so
the last one.
Kind of nice.
Yeah. You didn't answer me on, do you want to limit to one only per, and when we say property, per lot. We'll just go by lot.
Well,
I do.
I do.
Okay. I do too. Okay.
All right. One it is. That was easy. Parking spaces for renters. Do you want to allow them to use the public ways, or do you want them to be required to park on site?
Off street.
I'm for off street and also on street. We allow everyone else to park on street. My neighbors, you know, ADUs, they all park on street. I mean, it's just, what's our, you know, I don't see the justification for saying they can't park on the public right away when everyone else can.
The cities that have done it and required it to all be on the property, it's the difference they saw was that this person's making money and running a business and all the other people visiting the neighborhood are.
You know the policy arguments. One of the issues is if you, there could also be schemes where you give them one or two off streets. It's almost impossible to enforce a lot of that. I would probably lean toward an all or nothing thing just from the standpoint it's a little easier to enforce. It's still going to be hard because you don't know which car is.
When we get called, all we look at is the car legally parked?
Yeah. From a business licensing standpoint, if neighbors come in often to business licensing code and say, well, here's pictures of their people going in, it's not a police thing, we'll handle it through their license and say either fix the problem or we'll revoke your license.
So if we decided to say everything has to be on the property, that would be a surefire way to limit the number of people, really, unless they're Ubering in.
Or
but that would make it easier
the big
for
vans,
the police.
But yes.
It would make it easier for you. Because if we do the, I'm with you, like, oh, everybody else can park on the street.
Yeah.
But if we actually say, no, you can't, then it gives us a little bit of more leverage to enforce it.
Mm-hmm. It would stop the big Thanksgiving party where you're at the house and you invite 60 people over and they're all parked up and down the street. If we knew it was tied to that house. And that's the hard part, is to know if it's tied. But a lot of people, I'll just tell you, a lot of people who rent out their houses and stuff, they want to follow the rules once they know them. And so they're going to stripe four spots in because they have four, and you say you can have no more than four. I mean, you've probably seen listings like that where it says you can have no more than X number of vehicles.
But that way, if somebody's renting out two rooms in their house, they're going to put their private cars out on the street and let the STR people park in their driveway. It's forcing them to be creative. It's forcing them to say, I'm not going to just throw all these STR people out on this curb. I don't know.
There's good arguments on both sides. Parking is the biggest impact that most neighbors see with every rental. Even your model ones, if they bring in 15 people and 8 cars, that's where we'll get the call is the parking.
I like parking on the site.
They have to be on the property?
On the property.
I'm okay with that. I just think this is the one place I'm okay to put teeth in it.
Mr. Councilmember Johnson, you were on site too?
Yeah.
Okay. Charity, you love the dispersion. Go for it.
Go for what? I mean, there's options listed on here, and I already mentioned the justification for why cities have imposed dispersion requirements, more out of, you know, neighborhood fairness. It is obviously going to be enforcement issue, right? Because you can see how the dots are clustered, and if you put in a dispersion requirement and one neighbor gets the permit first, right, they're six, you know, next door neighbors aren't going to be able to get one.
Well, I know one cul-de-sac in my ward that has at least 5 right now.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So who
5 whole home or 5 parcels?
5 parcels that have.
No, but partial of the property or the whole property is short-term.
Partial of the property.
Yeah. And that may be one where if it's partial, you would allow them a little bit closer than whole homes.
And they're related too. They're like cousins, so that's going to make things really fun.
But they short-term out to their cousins?
No, to different people,
but they're all cousins.
They all built the homes in this subdivision together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they're financing their mortgages.
My only comment on this one is, and this whole conversation is, we have been elected to make difficult decisions, and we need to find the fine line. Private property ownership is the most important thing, and it's the private property of the people who want to rent out their homes and the private property of their neighbors and the quality of life and the impact of both. It is a fine line. It is a fine line, and we can come in really heavy-handed and say nothing is allowed, and then your neighbors are going to be happier. But we've got 240 active short-term rentals that are private property owners going to say, this is too much. You don't have the authority. You shouldn't be imposing on my private property rights. And if we don't do anything, then we continue to hear from neighbors that their private property rights are being violated by their neighbor. So we know that this is hard. It is difficult. I'm going to just tell you this dispersion requirement. If I were the neighbor who did have a permit, great. Actually, that's good. That's good for me. I don't have that. If I'm a neighbor who moves in and I'm told you can't do that because your next door neighbor did, to me, that feels like the conversation we just had about Google Fiber. Sorry, your neighborhood doesn't get it because you don't get it. Everyone else does, but there's a gap there and you don't get it. Why shouldn't the residents in my neighborhood be able to get it, right? And so I have a harder time with the requirements of only allowing every so often to do it.
And that goes into the next one, too, a total limitation. Both of those are first come, first serve.
You can also look at, you know, whether the owner's on the property and they're just doing a piece of their property, right, versus whether it's the entire property. You don't necessarily have to put dispersion requirements that apply the same to different types of rentals.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. If they're all partials, you could say no dispersion if they're partial. But if they're whole home, then you disperse them. But you'd have the same problem.
You would have the same problem, but that to me seems a little less heavy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Yes, it does.
Because you've said only one per property, so if they have an ADU type property.
And we've said they have to park on their property.
Yeah, if you have an ADU type property, you're not allowing two anyway. So it's either whole home or partial.
Could we say that those properties that do have a homeowner on them could be closer together?
I mean,
try to
write
it. That's going to be complicated, right? Mm-hmm. But we can try to figure if that's kind of the voice of the council.
Well, I'm just trying to think of how.
No,
right. How
we're thinking
thread that fine line,
good
right?
Exercise.
I mean, hey, Brian had a comment.
But,
go ahead.
If you do the dispersion thing, you're going to have a lot more enforcement time because people are going to say, like you just said, you know, and they're like, well, I'm just going to do it till they come after me and whatever, because that's what everybody else is doing. And I think the amount of time you're going to spend enforcing this is going to be a lot more if you limit it. But there are good reasons to limit. I mean, look at some of those.
I think if you went to a tiered approach, the easiest to write and enforce and somewhere in the middle of the impact, if you're trying to, you know, weigh out, would be something like no dispersion or a much smaller radius for the ADU short term. So a short term where it's someone, it's a separate one and a bigger one for a whole home. That's kind of in the middle somewhere. Or if you don't want it, no dispersion, or if you want the dispersion. It seems like we don't have, from staff perspective, I don't think it makes as big of a difference on the dispersion. Except that eventually, I guess, in, you know, a lawyer's theoretical world, the whole city could become short-term rentals.
Well, and they've been used, dispersion requirements have been used by other cities to limit what they're allowing, but not say clearly that they're limiting what they allow, right? Because if our city's long and skinny and we have like a 2 mile around each one, then we have four and we're finished, you know? So it's
not
it's,
that we didn't.
I'm not saying it's a bad, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad way to go, but it's been used, right, as kind of an inadvertent way to.
And frankly, if you're a LOAP, that may be a really important thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm okay with no. What's the rest of the council?
Both 8 and 9?
Just on 8.
Okay. Because 9's
so
a total
good.
Limit, because I
right.
kind of know. But
what does everybody else want on 8?
I'm fine with no. I don't think it needs to be the UAV.
Well, I just know in my district there are so many that are clustered together right now.
I
so
think that leads me to another question.
That's
what I mean.
So you can.
Is our intention to say to some of these purple dots, because of the rules we're putting in place, you no longer are allowed to have one?
I don't want
to
do that.
I don't want to do that either.
Neither do I.
So let's just say no.
That's why I look at my district there, the, you know, at the High Point and the Ivory, part of the Ivory Crossing North District.
They're clustered.
There's all clustered there. Mm-hmm. And really with the density of that area, it probably really doesn't matter that they're closer than
you, you could have a delayed
different housing options that are
if you like the dispersion but you don't want the impact, you could have a delayed dispersion requirement that kicks in after a year. So anybody that gets in the first year, it doesn't apply.
Neighbors hating neighbors and shooting BB guns. Let's just say no.
But it's still like in
a
year
or
someone
moves in. We
have
the parking that protects them. We have the one per property.
Well, and we're requiring fire inspections.
Yeah.
Some of these other things, I wonder.
Yeah, I'm okay. Just makes me wonder if we're ever going to have any pockets where this become a problem. You know, and that's what I was wondering about. It's like I think if you're if you think of like a metro area, you know, they're going to have some pockets where it could become problems or something on a beach or something. You know, just and so I'm trying to think in South Jordan where this could become. You know, I'm just trying to think if could we be creating a problem by not having something like this tool out there.
Going to Brian's point on, and that was a great point on the food trucks, we can bring this question, whichever way you choose, back and pencil it for 1 year and bring back and run the same report again and see if the clustering's getting worse, if it's dispersing, what's happening.
Yeah.
We could track this monthly, and there's a lot of things we can do to kind of help us understand what's going on.
I think that's a really good question. And because we're not a resort community, because I've tried to think about that too, I don't even think we're going to see, we know we're not going to probably see the whole jumble of these around the ballpark or whatever, because they're not even going to be able to do it.
No,
well,
and
right
so the
themselves.
HOA won't allow it. So
we have a lake and we have a ballpark, and those would be your resort areas.
So I agree. I'm like, we're not Garden City.
Yeah.
We're not St. George. We don't. So I can't see any area in the city, in the whole long boundary of the city, where I think, clearly, this is where it's going to be a problem. I there isn't anything that at least stands out in my mind that I feel like a prediction of where that could be.
And Mayor, you
well, I know three areas in my district that there's a high number of them. One of them is just north of Merritt Medical. That older neighborhood has a ton of them in there, and then along South Jordan.
And they're
Parkway.
Not showing on.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess they're showing on that
yeah,
top right
a,
there.
Just above the Redwood Room.
Yeah.
But if we made this rule, Kathy, what would happen in your area then? You've got a cluster, what's going to happen?
I don't know. I don't know how.
We would, if you gave us a dispersion requirement, the first one that came in, would, as long as they comply with everything else, get a license, and the rest we would deny based on the dispersion requirement. Unless you did some delayed effective date on the dispersion requirement, which would allow them all to get licensed, and then they can renew their license until they let it lapse. But in the future, the dispersion would kick in. But if someone bought a house, say, in 8 months after the delay ended, then, you know, they buy a house, they want a short-term their ADU, they couldn't ever until someone gave up their...
Nobody ever knows that when they buy a house.
They
that,
don't know.
They
nope.
never know that when they buy a house. And that it's.
They always assume they can.
They do assume they can. And and then they rightfully get upset when they find out, wait a minute, what? I just invested this all so much money into this house, and I thought I was going to be able to do this. And they don't know that. They never know that.
Yep.
Supposed to.
But they don't, right? They don't.
Well, just,
they don't
do their due yeah, just like yeah. HOA rules.
People
sign off saying they understand it, but they don't understand
yeah.
a single thing.
Well, and I'm looking at some of those. I think there's one or two HOAs in there that wouldn't allow them, and I'm seeing
yeah.
dots, and that's up to the HOA
mm-hmm.
to enforce, but
mm-hmm.
pretty sure some of those dots are where they wouldn't be allowed otherwise
mm-hmm.
through the rules.
For sure. And not to be Captain Obvious, but you're only talking about short term, right? They can still rent out their
mm-hmm.
property for 30 days or longer. Like, this is not going to touch any of those uses or those listings. It's only going to be, sorry, you can't do it.
So
you
if
know,
they can't short term, they
yeah.
may long term it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They still can.
They still have an option.
Do other things if you
yeah.
do.
Captain Obvious, that was good.
No, that is good.
Okay,
are we on number nine?
More?
We have 5 minutes
so,
left. Are we
so,
on number nine?
So is it a no on dispersion? It sounded
exactly.
like three, but maybe bring it back.
Let's watch it. I say no.
I think we're on no.
We will write it without.
You
if you reconsider, we'll have some language ready to substitute it.
I think it's something I need to ponder. I'm not sure how
it
will go.
What we'll do is, because I want to bring you back an ordinance. We will bring back an ordinance without it, but we will prepare language, a couple options, at least one option, maybe two, potential things you could put in if you choose to. Okay. All right, total limit. This is, again, a first-come, first-served thing.
And this is per person or per property?
No, this is the same. In the city, we're allowing 100 of them. So you cut it in half from 240 to 120, let's say. Or we have 240 today. We don't want more. Back in 2016, we had 48.
When someone sells a house, does the license stay with the house?
No.
Okay.
No, it's that's why we kept it out of land use, so it doesn't run with land. That was, he's not here, but Mr. Schaefermeyer and Brian, what they talked through with Charity and Vest. That's why we didn't want to invest
in
land.
We don't want to create any long-term.
100%.
I mean, you can also set them to be above, right? You could say no more than 350, right? So that we, so it won't go out of control before you can get your hands back on it. You know, we're not just issuing licenses.
We're going to look at this in a year, right?
Yeah,
if you want to. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's look at, we have right now 210, 260 in reality. Let's look next year. And if we see a huge exponential percentage increase, then we go back and say, wow, maybe we put a cap.
Go back.
That's my suggestion.
A couple of slides.
Yeah, didn't we have a 77% increase since 2021?
So that's what you've seen happen.
Yeah, the last 3 years, it's been 77%.
Pretty stable
increase.
The last year, it looks like. Well, it's bounced.
So it was during the post-pandemic when all the houses were out of control, expensive.
Yeah.
It's when it skyrocketed.
Yeah, when I looked it up just now, as I was looking at it, because there was listed in my neighborhood, I'm like, what? And I looked and I found one that's on there, and it's a friend of mine whose kids are older now and they're renting out their basement.
That's the 2016 to 2021, you went from 48 to 60.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're at 240. So what you could do is put in a top limit now of maybe 350. It'd be arbitrary-ish, but you put it in above. And that way you cap your risk for the next year review if you want it, or you just run the risk and then put in a cap after.
One of the arguments against short-term rentals is housing affordability. And
yes.
They make it housing more expensive because those are taking up market space.
Mm-hmm.
So for based off of that, I kind of feel more comfortable with putting some type of limit on it.
Yeah, I do too.
But what number? I'm not sure.
But you have 240 now, and so
tight to population, like liquor licenses.
You could do that.
I think
your
tying it to population is
up,
the right way to do it, rather than an arbitrary number, because our population is just going to keep going up. So a population
like a
percentage, rather than just a firm arbitrary number that is based on nothing, you know.
The one
supportive.
The one thing I take consider with just a pure population number is that the unit size, the lot size, are getting smaller overall, over time. So your population goes up, but then you're packing them in at different densities too. And that, but your parking requirement takes care of a lot of that. On a townhome, it's really hard to put a lot of parking and stuff. So you've got those balances, but that's just one thing that you may want to factor in.
I'd like to see something proposed based off of,
population. Okay. We can do that. Madam Mayor, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Did we manage to use it all up, or should we talk a little more?
We have more time.
You can feel free to speak.
Thank you so much.
You've got a minute and a half.
Okay. I hope you got what you needed from the council, and I appreciate this robust conversation. I think this is a difficult one. This is a hard one. Our aim, I believe, is to protect the integrity of our neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
We want to protect the quality of life and the integrity of our neighborhoods while not overreaching in people's personal property rights. It's hard.
Which is that it's a tough balance. You're right. It's a really hard choice to make. So thank you guys for making it.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, I'm going to ask for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, that's going to go to Mr. McGuire with a second to Mrs. Johnson. Okay. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right, we are adjourned. Thank you.